If you've ever posted a famous person's picture inside a locker or used it as a phone wallpaper, or if you've ever followed every moment of someone's career while sighing over their talent or beauty or great hair, you know all about pop culture crushes.
There are the ones you're proud of later, the ones you're less proud of later, and the ones that never quite go away. I'm Stephen Thompson.
And I'm Linda Holmes, and today we're talking about some of our first pop culture crushes on Pop Culture Happy Hour from NPR. Here with me and Stephen from his home studio bunker is Glenn Weldon of NPR's Culture Desk. Hey, Glenn.
Hey, Linda.
And also here is yet another crush-worthy member of our team, Aisha Harris. Hey, Aisha.
I'm swooning, Linda. I'm swooning.
Swooning, yes. So what we want to do is we are talking about some of our first pop culture crushes. I don't know if it's always going to be like the very first, but like one of the first. Mm-hmm. An early example. Aisha, we're going to have you kick us off. Go ahead.
Well, this is actually quite tough for me because I was definitely the kid who had lots of crushes very early on. I liked the boys.
Nice.
I could have said Aladdin. I could have said Rufio.
Solid.
But I'm going to go with the first one who was like worthy enough for me to write, I love this person's name all over my Trapper Keeper.
I was going to say Trapper Keepers have to enter into this conversation at some point.
Sure.
I had pictures, like I would post his face onto my notebook. I would tape it down and you just cover it in tape so that it wouldn't get worn or torn. It was like perfect.
Sounds like a pop culture crush.
It was. And that would be a one Kel Mitchell, who was the star of All That and also Kenan and Kel, mm-hmm. the great buddy comedy sitcom. When Kenan and Kel premiered, I'd already knew who Kel was, but I feel like my minor crush turned into a big, big crush. He was front and center all the time alongside Kenan. And one of the very first episodes, actually, was I think where I fell in love. And this is an episode, the show is so ridiculous, where Kenan is eating tuna and he starts choking while he's eating the tuna. And Kel saves Kenan while he's choking on his tuna, and there's revealed to be a screw in the tuna. And Kenan's like, oh, well, I can get rich quick, and I can sue this tuna company for all they've got because they are responsible for me almost dying and choking to death. And so there's a scene with Kel where he's on the stand. For some reason, this goes to court. I don't know why, but it goes to court.
Sure.
And they're in the courtroom, and Kenan ask Kel to talk about the day, what happened that day. And here is Kel's reaction on the stand.
I did it. It was an accident. I didn't mean it. I dropped the screw in the tuna. I dropped the screw in the tuna. It was me.
So he goes crazy for like about a minute or two where he is just jumping all over the courtroom. He's very skinny and limber and he's moving around and he goes up to the bailiff and he's like, help me. I didn't mean to do it. It was not my fault. And I think what I loved about Kel is that he was just goofy and funny. And if you ask a lot of women what they like in a man, why they might be with someone who otherwise you're like, why are you with this person? They make me laugh. And Kel made me laugh. And he was also very cute. I thought he had a little gap in his front teeth. I thought that was very cute. Uh-huh. And I thought he was really tall. 8-year-old me thought he was tall. Apparently he's like, according to IMDb, he's only 5'8 or somewhere around there. So he's not that tall.
Taller than you were.
Yeah, right.
Taller than I am now. That's for sure. So Kel Mitchell, I will forever hold a dear place in my heart for him. And I will forever wish that he had a similar career as Kenan, but it's okay. It's all right. He's still doing his thing. I follow him on Instagram. So he's still kind of a crush.
Nice. You know, I love a crush on a comedy person.
Yeah.
I feel like when we are very young, we don't always know enough to get our crushes from true comedy, like from the true world of broad comedy. And maybe I'm wrong about that, but I'm not sure everybody's that clued into what's really good in a partner.
Which brings me to my crush, Donald O'Connor. No.
All right. Speaking of gap between the front teeth, Stephen Thompson, I want to hear about your early pop culture crush next.
Well, this was tricky for me. I grew up in a small town in central Wisconsin in the mid to late 1980s. And it's very hard to extract those early crushy feelings from the environment that I was in, which included small town and very much included the 80s. And so the range of like what was presented as crush-worthy was very, very different than it is now. And in the spirit of a good Glenn Weldon taxonomy, I started to kind of scribble down the taxonomy of where a childhood crush comes from, like what it is rooted in. One is, of course, true attraction. We are developing true attraction at that time. There is obsessive fandom that takes on a crushing component, but isn't necessarily tied directly to physical attraction. There is the safe exploration of different sexualities and identities, kind of trying on crushes on famous people the way you would try on an outfit. And then there is what I was, which was terrified, deeply hormonal, and lying about who I was because I was in an environment full of deer-hunting Metallica likers. And I that didn't necessarily speak to me. Because my life has always been so deeply tied into a connection to music, every pop cultural crush that was presented to me, or that I at least that I think about in hindsight as having been presented to me, I write down musicians. So like Debbie Gibson and Tiffany were too pop. Mm-hmm. I couldn't find them attractive because they weren't cool enough. They weren't tough enough. Lita Ford, to me, a little too tough.
all right, Goldilocks. I see where this is going.
So the actual sweet spot that I landed on, and that I actually, in hindsight, feel fine about, was the great twin towers of female rock hotness, Anne and Nancy Wilson from the band Heart.
Okay.
Now, Heart had like a kind of rippin' 70s Magic Man, Barracuda, a bunch of songs that slapped then and slap now. But in 1985, Heart had kind of a cultural resurgence with a series of much more pop-friendly kind of soft rock power ballad songs like These Dreams, which we can hear a little bit of. So as somebody who was not necessarily, plugged into cool, heavy rock and roll the way I felt I was supposed to, Heart occupied kind of a safe space for me to have pop culture crushes, rock out very tentatively, and align myself with some music. Like, Heart's great.
Yeah.
You can still say I'm a Heart fan and not feel like a goober. So Heart ended up being kind of the perfect receptacle for my web of neuroses and crushes.
Interesting. All right. Thank you very much, Stephen Thompson. Glenn Weldon, hit me with some pop culture crushes.
Oh, geez. Well, I mean, I was hoping that mine would be revelatory. Like these, you're getting some insights about Stephen and Aisha. and instead, mine is, the adverb I'm going to go with is depressingly on brand. And it's just a reminder of how basic I am now and have always been. But the bonus, the good thing about my very first pop culture crush when I was very young, it comes with a theme song, and fair warning, it slaps.
Hercules, people are safe when near him. Hercules, only the evil fear him. Softness in his eyes, iron in his thighs, virtue in his heart, fire in every part of the mighty Hercules.
I mean, it's the best theme song. We will unpack those lyrics in a second, trust me. But before we do, do any of you recognize that crystal clear tenor voice?
It sounds familiar.
It is Johnny Nash, who 10 years after he recorded this theme song would go on to have a hit called I Can See Clearly Now.
I hear it now. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But you can hear it, right? Yeah. You can kind of hear it. So, but now let us all collectively take a beat to marinate in these lyrics. Softness in his eyes, iron in his thighs. I mean, a theme song that doubles as your grinder profile. You got to love the hustle, at least. Man. Now, this guy is only wearing a very skimpy toga, and you can see most of his parts. And this toga is so short that it's like the Hellenic equivalent of hot pants. the better to reveal the iron in his thighs. And to be clear, this is not Disney's Hercules, and it's not the Herculoids, the Hanna-Barbera thing, nor especially is it the Kevin Sorbo Hercules, because even I have a last lingering shred of self-respect. No, this is The Mighty Hercules, which was an American-Canadian animated series that produced five-minute episodes, 128 five-minute episodes. I caught up with it in syndication like 15, 16 years later. I was somewhere around five or six, and Linda, I think I caught it on Channel 48. WKBS-TV, Philadelphia.
Philadelphia.
Every single episode was exactly the same, except for the very first one where you get his origin story. So it's Hercules and Zeus hanging up on Mount Olympus. And we have to stop for the pedants out there because, yes, if his name is Hercules, his father should be Jupiter or Jove. You're mixing Roman with Greek. But, you know, just simmer down, Edith Hamilton, right? Because Disney did the same thing. Everybody does the same thing. So just let's chill. But speaking of Disney... Zeus in this origin story is serving you some serious King Triton daddy vibes. So Hercules wants to go to Earth to help the mortals, flying through the air in that very shorty toga, which flies up around him. And I mean, I will just merely note, you can see all kinds of side butt.
Did you clarify, is this animated or live action?
This is animated, okay. Yes. This
so they're animating the side butt.
Animating the side butt. Okay. In a rather crude way, but I was there for it. His girlfriend, is Helena, who he... proceeds to rescue. I always thought he seemed, to me anyway, six-year-old me, notably indifferent to her. Or most often he rescues his little twink centaur friend, Newton, who they seem more simpatico to me. They always did. Now, if you all will go kindly to the PCH Slack channel, I am going to send you a couple images culled from the internet of what this dude looks like.
Oh, man.
Oh, sure. Okay.
Yeah, see, now what I was hoping to hear from, I'm surprised. It's not surprising.
No.
He's got kind of a Johnny Bravo thing going on there.
To me, I look at this now today with my middle-aged eyes and I think, oh, I'm so basic. He is just another square-jawed muscle queen, and that I clearly imprinted upon like a tiny gay duckling. He was Conrad Lorenz in a toga. And I just want to go back to myself as a kid and go, dude, this is... Shake yourself out of this, because this is going to be your life. You're going to spend your life chasing this, chasing it in other people, chasing it in yourself. You are locking yourself in such a tiny cage. Aww. And you're doing it willingly, right? I mean, I would say to him, look, life is a banquet and you can go up to it and gorge yourself. But no, you're going to spend your entire life off in a corner at the table ordering the flavorless, joyless egg white omelet off the menu. It's going to take you far too long to shake any of that off. But that is mine. That is The Mighty Hercules. And listeners, you can check out these on YouTube. Be warned, they're not, what is the word, good, but they are seminal.
There you go. All right. So I both have very early pop culture crushes that are just very sad stories. I had a poster of Andy Gibb for a while when I was like tiny, like seven, really too little to process it as much of anything except... I have a poster of him because he is cute in that Minnesota North Stars hockey jersey. So it actually did get a little bit trickier than I thought. And so what I did is I slid forward to one of the early-ish, like firmly this was a crush that I recognized and treated as such, which was the great Frisco Jones from General Hospital 1, Jack Wagner. He came to General Hospital in 1984. As an add-on, essentially, to the character of Blackie Parrish, played by John Stamos, who was a young, rebellious teenager who had a band called Blackie and the Riff Raff, and Frisco Jones was the singer of the band. And if I have a type, it's not really this type. It's more like neurotic... weirdos. Mm-hmm. And he's more of kind of a blondish or sandy blonde, tall, obvious type of person. But I was really into him and also was a singer who released albums in his actual life.
Sure was.
But what I think is interesting about this is The soap opera crush was a precursor to the internet age crush in that it was a crush that could be fed constantly with new material because you came home every day. And if somebody was a regular on a soap, they were on maybe 4 days a week, 3 days a week. When I look back at it now, I'm like, I don't really get it. But he also did a long run on Melrose Place later. And when I watch those, I do get it on that because he's funny on that. And I think like perhaps like 13, 14 year old me somehow knew that deep down what he should be doing was comedy where he was kind of like a bad guy, which is sort of what he did on Melrose Place. It was a little more like delicious because he wasn't such a hero. But two add-ons to this. First of all, I saw him live in concert twice. I think both times were at the Valley Forge Music Fair, which is like a theater in the round kind of situation. One of those two times, the opener for him was a comedian named Roseanne Barr, who I saw in like 1985 or something like that. This is all prior, obviously, to her TV show and everything. Also, after he was done with Melrose Place and lots of other stuff, one of the things he has done is Hallmark movies. So I also saw him at a Hallmark movie event and I went over and I put my hand on his shoulder and I said, I just felt like I should come and say hello because I did see you twice live at the Valley Forge Music Fair. And he said, so like 1985. And I said, yep, absolutely. And we chatted. He was very nice about it. And I thought to myself, when he saw me coming, he would have been like, I know exactly what is about to happen. She loved me on General Hospital and saw me sing and just feels like I wouldn't feel right about it if I didn't come and say hello, which is exactly what happened. So like relatively speaking, I made it out alive with that one compared to some of the ones that I feel worse about.
You're the only one here who has actually met their pop culture crush.
Yeah, I've never met Anna Nancy Wilson.
It's true. And this only happened a few years ago. So for many, many years, I hadn't. I just...
Glenn's never met Hercules.
Nope.
Only in his dreams.
Only in my dreams.
I think you're destined to meet Kel Mitchell, though, Aisha. I feel like that's
true. Well, if he's listening, I love orange soda, too.
Well, we definitely want to hear about all of your pop culture crushes. Find us at facebook.com/PCHH or tweet us at PCHH. When we come back, it's going to be time to talk about what's making us happy this week, so don't go away. Now it is time for our favorite segment of this week and every week. What is making us happy this week? Glenn Weldon, what is making you happy this week?
The Worst Person in the World is a Norwegian film that I have a strong feeling we're going to be talking about again come Oscar time. It has made the shortlist for Best International Feature Film. A lot of critics love it. On the surface, very simple. It's about a young woman in Oslo who is trying to figure out what she wants to do with her life. And if she wants somebody by her side as she figures it out, or if she doesn't. It really captures the very thin, very kind of shifting membrane when you're that age between self-realization and selfishness, like what you owe yourself, what you owe other people at that stage of your life. The film's very naturalistic, but it allows itself these lovely moments of extreme stylization that I don't want to spoil, but just know that they're there to underscore how things feel very subjectively to you at that time of life. It is funny when it needs to be. It's very sexy when it needs to be. And it's also really messy and kind of painful when it needs to be. Mostly it just feels really truthful in a kind of clear-eyed way, a heartening way that I really admire. That is The Worst Person in the World.
All right. Thank you very much, Glenn Weldon. Aisha Harris, what is making you happy this week?
Well, Regina Hall has been around for a while. And at Sundance this year, I saw her in two really great performances. One was Honk for Jesus, Save Your Soul, and another is Master. And I'm sure we'll be talking about those later. But I've been aware of her for more than 20 years now. My introduction to her was the Scary Movie movies. And those movies came right at the perfect time for me because I was 12 and didn't know better when it came to humor. But to be honest, even though a lot of it doesn't hold up very well, so much of what does still work is Brenda, her character. In those movies, she is the Black best friend who is very aware of all the horror movie tropes and how Black people were the first to die. And she's ridiculous and she's silly. And her voice and the way she delivers all of those lines, even when they're silly, outdated sometimes, she just is such a breath of fresh air. And to see her go from Scary Movie to these more layered performances that she's had over the years, from movies I saw at Sundance to Girls Trip to Support the Girls, Regina Hall just makes me happy, and she is making me happy this week.
That is awesome. Regina Hall, thank you very much, Aisha Harris. Stephen Thompson, what is making you happy this week, buddy?
Well, in my line of work, it's very easy for me to get hung up on discoveries and talk about new artists that I want people to check out. And what sometimes happens, a real occupational hazard, is I sometimes forget to listen to those artists' subsequent records. And so I never really got around to spending a lot of time with the album Stand For Myself by the singer Yola that came out last year. Now, Yola is no longer a new discovery. She's nominated for 2 Grammys this year. She has already played her Tiny Desk concert. She is a big deal. But this record is just a wonderful kind of continuation of that thing that she does so well. She mixes kind of vintage soul with country and blues and dance music in this just really wonderful, timeless, spirited way. But she just writes that way. And I actually want to play my favorite song from this record. It is nominated for a Grammy. It's called Diamond Studded Shoes. Listening to the song, I feel this kind of conditional love of it. Conditional only because I love it now. I will probably love it less when I hear it 700 times at a political convention. It is that kind of song. But she is just wonderful, and she continues to make fantastic music. And I'm making mental notes to make sure I continue to follow her wherever she goes and not just move on to the next new thing.
So that is Yola, Stand For Myself. Thank you very much, Stephen Thompson. So what is making me happy this week? Sometimes you just have to read the book that everybody says is good and admit that the book that everybody says is good is really good. I say this as I am about a third of the way through Devil House, which is the new novel by John Darnielle. John Darnielle is at the center of the Mountain Goats, is a really, you know, highly recognized and admired songwriter, and has also for the last, you know, bunch of years been sort of developing a reputation as a novelist. It's a big, hard-fought book. It is the story of a guy who is a true crime writer who has written a bunch of books, some sort of more respectable, some maybe a little less respectable, in which he goes back and investigates crimes and, you know, tries to figure out what really happened. And Devil House is a reference to an actual house where a terrible crime occurred that he goes and moves into as he's going to write a book about this. It's one of those things where, like, how good at words can one person be is a thing that is sometimes a frustration if you're a writer. It's like, it really makes you feel like a hack, I think, when you read this guy's writing. That has been my experience. But it is a really smart, really pleasurable, but also really thoughtful novel. And I just think so incredibly highly of it. And by the time you hear this episode, I will almost surely have finished it. It's called Devil House. It's by John Darnielle. And you can get it wherever you get your books. And I do highly recommend it. And not just the first third of it. I'm sure it's all good. And that's what's making me happy this week. If you want links for what we recommended, plus some additional recommendations, subscribe to our newsletter. That's at npr.org/popculturenewsletter. That brings us to the end of our show. You can find all of us on Twitter. You can find me at Linda Holmes. You can find Stephen at I Dislike Stephen. Glenn is at G.H. Weldon, and Aisha is at Crafting My Style. You can find our editor, Jessica Reedy, at Jessica_Reedy. Our producers, Candace Lim at The Candace Lim, and Ramel Wood at Blurgosphere. And you can find producer Mike Katziff at Mike Katziff, K-A-T-Z-I-F. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides the music that you are tapping your feet to right now. Thanks to all of you for being here and coming clean about your pop culture crushes.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And of course, thank you for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour from NPR. We will see all of you next week.